Chapter 4. Very, Very Worried. January 2nd, 2018. The smell of marijuana was overpowering. I was surrounded by cannabis plants easily stacked 10 feet high on all sides of me. It was just before 4 in the morning, Los Angeles time. Hey, Jacob, can you hear us? Jacob? In my ear, I could hear a voice talking to me. But I wasn't bugging out. At least I don't think I was. Jacob, good morning. It's Studio 1A. Can you hear us? I can. Good morning. Great. Stand by for rehearsal. This is just a rehearsal. This was the day recreational pot was legalized in California, and anyone over the age of 21 could buy what used to be referred to as the devil's weed without fear of getting locked up. The days of massive hauls of marijuana across the southern border had already started to taper off. With pot being grown and sold in a regulated market, the need for it to be smuggled from Mexico into the United States was fading away. Today, in between ports of entry, you were much more likely to meet a family seeking asylum crossing the border than you were a narco-trafficker, as I learned from Sidney Aki at the Port of San Ysidro. Customs and Border Protection continually pointed to statistics indicating they were still seizing loads of pot in the Rio Grande Valley and southern Arizona, two places along the border I had not yet been, but was hoping to visit soon. My border reporting of late had been focused not on drugs, but what the consequences of deportations would mean for so-called mixed-status families, those with some family members arriving undocumented with others born in the United States and receiving American citizenship, just like the Georgias I met near Tijuana in November. 12 days after my weed live shot, I was in New York City to appear on the Today Show again, this time to share their story with the world. I walked into Studio 1A and waited in the wings, ready to sit down at the famous desk known behind the scenes as Home Base, makeup applied by the pros in the basement green room, microphone and IFB hooked up by the techs in the corner of the studio, and blue wool suit jacket and tie freshly lint-rolled by the wardrobe department. While Al Roker ran through the national forecast, I took my seat at the table to the left of Hoda Kotb and Savannah Guthrie, directly across from Carson Daly and Craig Melvin. Morning, guys, I whisper while giving a little wave. Hey, Jacob, they say back in unison, also in TV quiet voice, but a little less quiet than mine since this is their show after all. All right, Al, thank you, Guthrie says, as Roker wraps up, and not missing a beat, she turns right to my story. Now to the raging debate over immigration and a group that is left in limbo. Hundreds of thousands of children born here in the United States. NBC's Jacob Soboroff is here with more on that. Good morning, you guys. I tee up the segment we filmed several months before, reading my introduction off the teleprompter in front of me, careful not to get too far ahead of myself, and landing on my roll cue, the signal that tips off the control room it's time to run the taped portion of my report. In Mexico, it's a question they've been dealing with for years, I said, as footage began. As the spot played, Hoda, Savannah, Al, Carson, and Craig watched in monitors placed under the glass top table or under the cameras surrounding us. We sat there together as I, in the spot, told the story of how George Sr. had been deported for a crime and his American citizen son, George Jr., went with him to Mexico instead of staying behind in California. It was a decision that tens of thousands of families were making, many with no criminal record at all, only the civil violation of entering the United States illegally. There were so many kids like George that the public school system in Baja California was now teaching students English language curriculum designed in conjunction with American teachers. The report ended with George insisting, as he had to me that day on the beach, that he would trade the million-dollar Mexican beach view for his million-dollar family. The control room cued me to start again reading the teleprompter, wrapping up the spot live. Talking way too fast, I jumped in. There are at least 200,000 American-born kids dreamers that are facing deportation. If that were to happen, every single one of those kids, they would face a situation just like George did. They gotta find a way to stay in the U.S., I said, breaking away from the teleprompter and turning to my colleagues to explain how the Georgia story overlapped with President Trump's continuing threat to end DACA. Or follow their parents to a foreign land. That's why these schools are teaming up, California and Mexico, to keep these kids educated and keep them in the program so they don't feel like they're in a foreign place. At this point, I waited to see if one of the regular cast members would have something to say, a sign the story had captured their attention, or send me off with a simple thank you. It's the TV news equivalent of Johnny Carson asking you to stick around on the couch for another segment. Guthrie jumped in. Well, I like how educators are trying to, you know, do their best in a difficult situation, she remarked. Making the best of a terrible situation, I replied, glad that what was going on at the border had resonated. Good story, Jacob. Thank you. And with that, I was done, and the show pivoted back to lighter fare. Still to come, Cotby teased, we've got Jill's deal of the day, the best bargains on stylish winter fashion, plus sinless sweets. Thanks, guys. Have a good one, I told the cast and crew as I headed off set. As I did, it was hard not to think about how the world of mainstream media is so weird, pivoting from the deadly serious to the silly with almost no transition. Switching gears is a thing we're all trained to do and a phrase often utilized in broadcast news. I was grateful to the brass at Today and NBC News for turning to me for stories like this and putting them on the air. But is it what our audience wanted to see? In an ill-advised move I make far too often, I checked Twitter after the report aired. The parent broke the law by entering illegally and then continued to break the law by dealing drugs. The consequences the child is suffering are solely on the parent, one user replied. Send their kids back with them, said another. Doubt washed over me. Would a story like the one I just presented make a difference in this environment? Was it getting through to the audience tuning in for the deal of the day that my report was about more than one father who made a serious mistake and his son living with the consequences? Insofar as I was thinking about separation as I walked away from Studio 1A, it was how some in our audience and so many others were separated from the reality of how immigration policy was creating thousands of Georges, rippling through virtually every part of our country. As I thought of others, I too was separated from how extreme that reality was. A few hours after I got off the air at 30 Rock, Jennifer Podkol walked into the Mary E. Switzer Federal Building in Washington, D.C., the headquarters of the Administration for Children and Families. The grand structure looks more like a train station than a federal office complex, and a historian of architecture or the website of the General Services Administration, which maintains the building, would tell you the style is a combination of Art Moderne and abstracted Egyptian revival. I looked it up. It was designed to house the National Defense Commission and the Department of War, although neither department ever moved in, despite the fact the building opened before World War II. Podkol, an immigration policy wonk, had served in the Peace Corps in Honduras before becoming the Senior Director for Policy and Advocacy at KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, a nonprofit organization founded by Microsoft and Angelina Jolie to make sure no refugee child faces court alone. She had burning questions for Commander Jonathan White and his colleagues at the Office of Refugee Resettlement. She wanted to press ORR leadership about the family separations that by all indications were happening, despite the government's repeated denials. Is this going to happen? She wondered. Or not? Is everyone prepared? Podkol wasn't alone in her concerns. ORR holds a regularly scheduled stakeholders meeting with the service providers who take care of the thousands of migrant children in the custody of the federal government, both while they're detained in custody and once they're out of it. This month was different. Podkol had seen Lomi Creel's report in the Houston Chronicle, and having heard some of the same anecdotal reports from lawyers she worked with, she was worried about the prospect of family separations happening on a wide scale. Her fears were also based on years of research into the practice. 10 days before Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States, Podkol and her colleagues at KIND, along with the Women's Refugee Commission and the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, published a report called Betraying Family Values: How Immigration Policy at the United States Border is Separating Families. The report's cover featured a photo of a family of four in silhouette, behind a chain-link fence topped by barbed wire and looking out at a city in the distance as a helicopter flies by. It is an indictment of decades of immigration enforcement, illuminating how it has contributed to family members being separated from one another. Quote, over the last year, a disturbing new trend has emerged at the U.S. border, families torn apart. As an increasing number of families migrate together to the United States, the number of documented cases of family separation has escalated. The dozens of cases examined for the report make clear that family separations during the Obama administration were haphazard and not systematic, making tracking of families and ultimately reuniting them a challenge. Families were being separated when a child migrated with anyone other than their parent or legal guardian, including cousins, grandparents, and aunts or uncles. In addition, separations were occurring when a parent was prosecuted for illegally entering or re-entering the United States, a practice that was ramped up as part of a consequence delivery system to deter families from migrating. Between 2012 and 2017, the report explains, the United States has seen a shift in the demographics of migrants entering at our borders, from a majority of adult males, often from Mexico, seeking employment, to families, children, grandparents, aunts, and uncles fleeing together, seeking protection in the United States, coming mostly from Central America. Tragically, U.S. immigration enforcement policies, instead of shifting to adapt to this significant change, have continued to try forcing a square peg into a round hole, and in doing so, have compounded the vulnerabilities of families and protection-seeking migrants. Instead of promoting family unity, we as a nation are breaking families apart. There was no question, based on the cases studied, of the consequences of family separations. The practice, regardless of why it was carried out, quote, negatively impacts emotional and psychological development and well-being, creates security and economic difficulties, and strips the dignity of an individual and their family as a whole. During the Obama administration, a blanket family separation policy had been considered and even discussed in the Situation Room, but it wasn't adopted. The report, a warning of sorts ahead of the Trump administration, lays out how there were actually multiple policies that resulted in family separations, and the lack of an overall federal policy to protect the well-being of those separated made it worse. Now separations were reportedly happening on a wider scale, deliberately, and Podkol feared the coming ramifications. Along with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, she submitted questions to be addressed by ORR staff at the monthly meeting. How is ORR preparing for the administration's plans to separate families at the border? What kind of impact will this have on ORR, and how will ORR manage a potential large increase of referrals? Has DHS consulted ORR on this policy consideration and asked to provide a child welfare perspective? KIND/LIRS. Podkol went in with the philosophy that, quote, it was like throwing spaghetti at the wall. Armed with so many questions, she assumed she would get some answers. She was in good company. The meeting agenda shows nearly every other stakeholder and service provider submitted similar questions. Can ORR please share any new trends it's seeing with regard to family separation? Is ORR working to coordinate with ICE and/or DHS on family separation cases? CARA. USCRI has noticed an increase in family separation, particularly single fathers traveling with their young children. The fathers have been deported, leaving the children, some as young as 2 years old, in the care of extended family. What steps, if any, is ORR taking to address this issue, and how can we as service providers assist when we learn during the home study process that the biological parents would like the child to return to their care in home country? USCRI. At the last meeting, ORR mentioned that it would look into its ability to collect information/data on children in its custody as a result of family separation due to immigration enforcement by CBP or ICE. What has ORR determined in this regard? WRC. Has or is ORR considering establishing a mechanism or a policy to facilitate family communication and other needs in the event of a separation? WRC. LIRS has found a common problem for kids seeking voluntary departure in order to reunify with their parent prior to departure is delayed court proceedings. Even when cases are expedited, the court date is often still many weeks away, and ICE decides it cannot wait that long. Would ORR be willing to do outreach to EOIR, about expediting these types of cases so that a child isn't separated from a parent in ORR custody for unnecessary long periods of time. LIRS. What is ORR's policy when ICE wants to take custody of a child that is in ORR care? Vera. The questions Podkul and her colleagues were asking were the same ones that she had been trying to answer for years. Only now, the number of children who would be affected could end up exponentially higher. While separations could happen for a variety of reasons, what she wanted done boiled down to a simple question she would ask the government over and over again. Can't you make a checkbox? Podkul knew that without a way to designate that children were separated from family members in the federal government's records, none of which interacted with each other, including relevant agencies like ORR, the Border Patrol, and ICE, family members would lose track of one another. She had even asked similar questions several months earlier at a November stakeholder meeting. All that yielded was more questions. Sometimes ORR is informed at the referral point if a child was separated from a family member. She and her fellow stakeholders were told about how ORR is notified if a child is separated. Sometimes. There's no agency-wide policy on what to do if it is found out that a child has been separated from a parent. Cases are worked on at the individual level, it was explained to her, she recalled. None of that was much help in November. And again, several months later, Podkul found herself equally frustrated. We didn't want any kids to fall through the cracks. Others in the room, of course, had a strong indication of what was going on. Internal ORR data about the increasing number of separations. Overheard conversations by White House staffers. Carelessly shared details by the Border Patrol. But White and other ORR officials present used the session to gather intelligence from those with boots on the ground, like Podkul, more than to answer questions that were raised. Even though it's in question format, it's a way for them to tell me, this is what we're seeing, X, Y, and Z, an ORR official who was in the room later told me. They probably know I haven't seen X, Y, and Z, but that I'm going to go look for X, Y, Z. While Commander White was hearing similar anecdotal reports, there was nothing he could officially confirm about a separation policy. It was continually denied by his superiors. The conversations in this and other stakeholder meetings stayed secret by design. It's not an official government meeting, the ORR official told me, because otherwise I would have to broadcast it, allowing others to join who may not share the same goal, in this case preventing family separations. As Podkul walked out of the meeting, she was very, very worried. They knew this would harm kids on a personal level, she told me. And on a personal level, I felt bad for the ORR employees there. But they would have to clean up the mess. White remained distressed, too. Meanwhile, on the border, migrants kept coming, oblivious to what was awaiting them. January 17, 2018. An email landed in my inbox just after lunch. Subject, The Wall. It was from Paul Ryan, a senior producer at Dateline, the legendary NBC news magazine. Though today it's most often associated with true crime stories, Dateline is also the network's venue for deep dives into newsy issues and investigative journalism. Copied on the email were Izar Harpaz and Simon Doolittle, two Dateline producers. Hey guys, we want to do an hour on the border for March. Jacob, we'd love it if you could be the correspondent. Izar and Simon will co-produce. Simon and I wrote a pitch over a year ago for this. I'm attaching it here. The idea is to travel the length of the border, stopping in a few key places. Some of this pitch is probably out of date. Simon is figuring that out now. Given recent developments and the current situation, we'll have to have new elements too. Plus, Jacob, you've no doubt shot a ton along the border the last year or two. It would be great to know what that is. Maybe there are things you've already done that we can integrate. Jacob, I see you're in New York. Maybe we can all get together in person or over phone to discuss later today or tomorrow. I couldn't contain my excitement and wrote back right away. I'd absolutely love this. and I'm currently working on our next story on the wall to be pegged to the State of the Union, so I'll bring you up to date. And yes, I'm here. Anytime after 2, I'm free. What works for you? And for reference, here's our reporting on the wall slash immigration over the past year. I highlighted the stuff that's most relevant. I had pulled this together for Janelle last week. I attached the list of stories, as promised, that I had assembled for my boss Janelle Rodriguez, NBC News' senior vice president of editorial, who had consistently pushed us to work from the border to show the realities on the ground. That same day, we met and discussed the project and agreed to get to work in February. But first, as I told everyone by email, I had to head out on assignment for an immigration story pegged to President Trump's first true State of the Union. Did you see the two that went south? A Border Patrol agent rolled up to me and two officials from Hidalgo County, Texas, as on the 25th day of January, we were touring portions of 20 miles of existing steel bollard border fencing high atop a levee constructed during the George W. Bush administration. President Trump was days from the State of the Union, where he would be pushing for Congress to fund his big, beautiful border wall, including in this part of South Texas, where I was getting an up-close look at the border infrastructure already in place. Still up in the air, a federal budget deal to fund a Trump wall, and the fate of the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients. We were just out the back door of the old Hidalgo Pump House, today a museum and part of the World Birding Center, a global attraction for many birdwatchers, but a century ago, the facility performed exactly what it sounds like. Pump water from the Rio Grande to farms along its banks. I was finally visiting the Rio Grande Valley for the first time, now the place where more migrants were crossing into the United States illegally than anywhere else. The previous month, newly confirmed Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen had visited the area, proclaiming it would be the first place the Trump administration would build his border wall. I wanted to check it out for myself. In order to get a local view of what was happening here, our team had linked up with elected officials Judge Ramon Garcia and Commissioner David Fuentes. A generation apart, Garcia was on the precipice of retirement, and Fuentes, newly elected to the county commission. Both were Democrats, the rule rather than the exception for local elected officials in the borderlands, despite the national conversation about their home being dominated by Republican talking points. What we were witnessing was familiar to both of them, lifelong residents of the Rio Grande Valley. "No, sir," one of them said to the agent, who was still sitting in the unmarked four-door gold pickup truck he had arrived in, responding to his query about missing migrants. The agent had parked at an electronic gate in front of the 15 or so foot tall, rust-colored border barrier. I asked Garcia, "They're out doing what they do, right?" "They're out doing their job." "And this is part of that, I guess," I quip, pointing to the border wall behind us. As I do so, the agent, stocky and not quite as tall as his pickup, slides down from his seat, boots kicking up dust from the dirt road beneath us. He walks up to an electronic keypad that operates the gate and the fencing. "Well, as you can see, it's not holding them," Garcia points out to me. "Right, it's not holding them." Them being the migrants, of course, who were now on the run from the Border Patrol in the brush surrounding the old pump house. "Right," the judge repeats with a Texas drawl. "It's a very impractical thing, very expensive thing to construct. And it doesn't work." The agent taps the code into the keypad, which starts the gate opening, and he jumps back into his truck to search for the two who went south as other agents arrive as backup. "So what you're saying," I say, falling into a verbal tick I have when reporting on camera, repeating back to the subject what they've just told me, "is that even though the president wants to build new stuff, we're seeing in real time an example of people who are crossing right around this fence right here." "That's correct," Garcia confirmed. We walked several yards down the dirt road where the border wall ended, but it became clear we weren't just at the base of a border wall. We were atop a levee here. I peeked over and made note that even without the 15-foot border wall on top, the levee itself was not easy to scale. "There's no wall here, but if you look over the edge, come check this out, Carlos," I say, motioning to Carlos Cal Huzano, the cameraman who made the trip with Arnie and me from Los Angeles. We're talking about at least 15 feet down. You don't have to have a fence in order for it to be a border wall. You build a 15-foot wall, they'll build 18-foot ladders, Commissioner Fuentes responds as my head dangles over the side of the levee, looking at the drop below. I don't get it, I think to myself. What's the point? If you build it, they will get around it. Maybe the Trump administration knows something I don't. The Secretary of Homeland Security came out here, stood right in front of a wall just like this, and said this is going to be the first place we build new wall in the country. Is that true? Fuentes raised his eyebrows, shrugged his shoulders, and cracked half a smile. You'd probably have to ask her, he said with a chuckle. You know what I mean? I still didn't quite get it exactly. If that's what they're thinking, Fuentes continued, I think the most natural way would probably be they'd have to start on federal property. Because I can't see anybody here locally that's already agreed to sell their property. As we talked, the chase continued with agents on both sides of the border wall, the old pump house side, and the strange no man's land that was in between the wall and the Rio Grande, the real border with Mexico. Fuentes's point was a good one. Here, that no man's land was owned by the county, which is why during the Bush administration, the federal government was able to make an agreement and build this portion of border fencing here. But it wouldn't be as easy to build elsewhere in the Lone Star State, home to more of the U.S.-Mexico border than anywhere else. 95% of the land in this state is privately owned, including much of the border. Fuentes explained to me that there were only a few miles of border that would be readily available to the Trump administration to build on, and they were owned by the federal government itself, including the Santa Ana Wildlife Refuge, 8.5 miles to the east by car. Off we went. The refuge is more than 2,000 acres, and it too is a world-class birding destination. It's home to nearly 3 river miles of border, the actual distance of winding Rio Grande that passes through it. But a proposal uncovered by the Sierra Club to build a border wall through it would render most of the park itself a no man's land, with a wall built on the existing levee designed to protect the area from flood miles away from the river itself. I met Jacqueline Trevino there, a yoga teacher and student who in her spare time is a volunteer activist for the Sierra Club. She was dressed like I was for weather from another part of the country. It was chilly in South Texas, meaning the temperature wouldn't break 60. Her red pea coat and scarf punched through the gray of the sky, a fog that hung low over the Santa Ana Refuge. As we walked along the levee right out the back door of the visitor center at the park, Trevino, another lifelong resident of the Rio Grande Valley, gave me a tutorial on how many residents bordering the river have lived there since before the end of the Mexican-American War in 1848, and retained property granted to them by the Spanish before that. It's for that reason her colleagues at the Sierra Club uncovered the Army Corps of Engineers ranked the Santa Ana Refuge as the place it would be easiest to build new border wall in the area. Most people, as Commissioner Fuentes told me earlier that day, wouldn't sell. It is very low-hanging fruit for the administration because it's a federal wildlife refuge and they already own the land, she reminded me. We entered the park, walking the winding paths and past groups of chakalacas, birds that look like a cross between a quail and a turkey. They screeched at each other as they battled for territory in the tree branches around us, not able to fly for long distances. Breeding season was approaching. They scared the hell out of me. It felt like a rooster had been placed inside my ear canal. Trevino brought us to a white lookout tower several stories tall. We climbed the stairs and at the top, above the tree canopy, we could see smoke rising from Reynosa, Tamaulipas, just across the Rio Grande in Mexico. This is the highest elevation, she points out. The middle of the Rio Grande is the actual U.S. border, which is miles in that direction, I say, pointing to the smoke cloud over Reynosa. So in between what they would build as the border wall over there and the river over here, what would this become? No man's land, she replies. Back down on the levee, it's becoming clear to me that Trump's dream of an end-to-end border wall was destined to be a mirage at best. Even if Congress gave Trump every penny of the wall funding he was going to lobby for during the State of the Union, it would not be nearly enough to overcome the obvious obstacles. The reason they want to build here is there's a chance they can't build anywhere else in Texas, I say to Trevino. Right. It'll get tied up in courts, eminent domain lawsuits and such, she says, referring to the fact that a third of those cases that started during the George W. Bush administration are still not resolved. They could extend another 10, 12 years before construction actually begins. So there's a chance that during Donald Trump's presidency, he may not build any border wall unless he builds it where we're standing right now? Absolutely. We returned to Los Angeles and spent most of the next 5 days on the back lot at Universal Studios Hollywood. Thanks to our corporate parents at Comcast, it's where the NBC News Los Angeles Bureau has been based since 2014, the year before I arrived at the company. After I wrote out a first draft in a shared Google Doc with producers Mitch and Arnie, we went through several rounds of notes with our bosses in New York on the report we filmed at the border, answering questions about the details of our story. Once we had approvals from Janelle Rodriguez and Betsy Corona, who were both supervising our tiny unit within NBC News from offices inside of 30 Rock back in New York, I carefully crafted an email pitching the story to the senior producers who run the daytime shows on MSNBC and to the executive producer of Morning Joe. I said I envisioned going back down to the border, this time in San Diego, to present the report live on the day of the State of the Union. The shows bought it and down we went, overnighting in San Diego. Early the following morning, around 4, we hopped in the car and drove to the border again, this time nearly 2,000 miles to the west. We got set up at a place known to the Border Patrol as Arnie's Point, an overlook where those same primary and secondary fences I had seen on previous trips here were directly below us, illuminated along with the all-weather roads between them by stadium-style lighting. Just beyond it was Colonia Libertad, one community in Mexico through which hundreds of migrants used to cross daily for work, though today they're not able to because of the shift in tactics, including the layers of fencing built by the Border Patrol during the Clinton and Bush administrations. First up for the day was Morning Joe. Camera set, earpiece in, coffee starting to do its thing. It was around 5:30 local time. In tonight's State of the Union address, President Trump is again expected to call on Congress to again fund his border wall, said co-host Mika Brzezinski, on set back at 30 Rock in front of a video image of the White House on the giant digital screen behind her. But if he does, will it ever be built? MSNBC correspondent Jacob Soboroff went to the U.S. southern border to investigate, and he joins us now. Jacob, what'd you find out?
Here near San Diego, they already have a border wall, I start to explain, doing my best to stick to the script I wrote on the back lot.
I swept out my arm to draw attention to the fencing that divides two communities through which for decades people traveled freely. The same cannot be said across the country in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, and in fact, that's where, in her first week on the job, the Secretary of Homeland Security said this is going to be the first new place we build President Trump's border wall. But residents down there know, and they've known for a long time, that's a promise that's pretty hard to keep. With that cue, the experiences we had less than a week earlier began broadcasting to the American people. The Border Patrol chase for the two men who went south around the existing border fencing. My conversations with the local elected officials. And finally, my tour of the wildlife refuge with Trevino, the Sierra Club activist. Back live again, I wanted to put as fine a point as I could on our story. Even if the administration got every penny they asked for to build the wall, $25 billion, $35 billion, whatever the number is, the reality down there is it's going to be up to the private landowners of South Texas whether or not this wall ultimately gets built. And get this, from the Bush administration, when they tried to build a wall down there under President George W. Bush, there were around 300 lawsuits about the wall. Still today, a third of those are tied up in litigation. This is something that might never, ever happen down there, even during Donald Trump's presidency, guys. Wow. Jacob Soboroff, thank you very much for that report, Mika replied. Almost immediately, the on-air conversation shifted to the Russia investigation underway by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. That, to me, was an indication of how the day might go. and another reminder of the vacillating level of interest in what was actually happening at the border. I was right. I appeared on air twice more that day to little effect. "We're clear for the day," I told Arnie after a phone call with headquarters in which I learned our services were not going to be needed during our marquee primetime coverage of the State of the Union. Not even to fact-check President Trump in real time. We packed up our cars and hopped on the freeway. It was only around noon local time, and on both the 805 and the 5, there was something missing. An indication of why it seemed nobody back in New York was much interested in having us on air. For decades, yellow road signs framed both of those freeways as you drove away from the U.S.-Mexico border, with images of a silhouetted mother and father literally pulling their little girl by the arm, ostensibly running across the freeway and away from immigration enforcement. The iconic immigrant crossing signs were placed on these very roads by Caltrans, the state agency that oversees highways in California. At first, according to the Los Angeles Times, the signs were text only, reading, "Caution, watch for people crossing road." When motorists couldn't digest what they said in time, Caltrans hired John Hood, an artist, to create the image now so familiar to so many drivers in this part of the country. "It doesn't just mean they're running across the freeway," the Times quoted Hood as telling the San Diego Union-Tribune in 2005. "It means they're running from something else as well. I think it's a struggle for a lot of things. For opportunities. For freedom." Now, at a time when migrant crossings, particularly here in the San Diego sector, were near all-time lows, there wasn't a need for the signs. The last one was pulled down in September 2017. We made it home in time to catch Trump's State of the Union speech live on television. The president, of course, hammered his immigration applause lines. "For decades," he boomed, "open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities." Nobody told him why they took down the signs, I thought to myself. Or more likely, he just doesn't care about what's actually happening at the border. President Trump introduced parents of children killed by undocumented immigrant gang members and used their stories as justification for calling on Congress to, quote, "close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminals to break into our country. We have proposed new legislation that will fix our immigration laws and support our ICE and Border Patrol agents so that this cannot ever happen again." He went on at one point strongly implying that he wasn't going to need his border wall to deter migrants from coming into the country. "Crucially, our plan closes the terrible loopholes exploited by criminals and terrorists to enter our country. And it finally ends the dangerous practice of catch and release." What he didn't say was that this plan to close loopholes, a euphemism for how his administration would deter asylum-seeking families and unaccompanied children from coming to the United States, was already moving from theory to practice. The morning after the State of the Union, Commander Jonathan White fired off an email to a Health and Human Services colleague. He admitted he had gotten into an argument with Gloria Chavez, the commander of the Border Patrol's Migrant Crisis Action Team, or the MCAT, in Washington. Chavez was the same Border Patrol official who in December had inadvertently admitted to an Office of Refugee Resettlement staffer the Border Patrol had been working on scaling up family separations. Now she had written Commander White with a request. Chavez wished to better understand the release of unaccompanied minors in the custody of his department. Children who were separated would be rendered unaccompanied despite the fact they didn't arrive as such. "Good afternoon. Can you assist with the below? I found the below statement on your HHS website and I'm wondering if one of you are available to discuss further. We are trying to get educated on the below process as it pertains to UACs and their sponsors." White politely replied, "Yes, we sure can." Still, Chavez's request annoyed White, who wrote to his colleague to suggest it might be better for someone else to help with her request. "I alienated this group last week when I called BS on the DHS argument that the combination of the MOA, Memorandum of Understanding, and a new policy to separate children from family units and designate them UAC, unaccompanied alien children, would only require 4,000 DHS ORR beds for the MOA and 9,000 for the MOA plus family unit separation. So we can start cutting beds now, according to DHS's estimates. So I need to be solicitous and kind to them today. Bed space, technically speaking, is the number of children the agency can care for. Each bed comes with a cost, and that money needs to be appropriated by Congress. Chavez was arguing for a reduction in the number of beds from current levels. Commander White found that ludicrous in the face of a potential separation policy, and an in-development memorandum of understanding signed between Health and Human Services and the Department of Homeland Security. The controversial document would require the fingerprinting of all members of a household in which a minor discharged from ORR custody would live, including undocumented family members. Commander White feared both would slow discharge rates, thereby creating a need for more beds, not fewer, as Chavez was suggesting. Commander White's team had calculated that those policies, if enacted, would require a threefold increase in the number of children referred to ORR. His estimate was that over 30,000 beds would be necessary in a worst-case scenario. Despite the fact that a DHS statistician had modeled the same number as Commander White's team, Chavez claimed the number was too high, as it did not account for the broader deterrence effects of both policies. That set off Commander White, who, in essence, called bullshit on the argument directly to Chavez. That meant, at least for today, he wanted someone else to speak with her. "Got it," his colleague wrote back. February 20th, 2018. "That's it?" I was staring through a tiny hole in the sheet metal of primary border fence in Otay Mesa, California, 6 miles to the east of the San Ysidro crossing where I had, by now, visited many times. "That is it," replied Border Patrol Agent Lance Lenoir, not lacking bravado. "That's the infamous lowering bathroom floor entry." "What do you mean?" "The bathroom floor literally lowered down to provide access to the tunnel." "So, inside that warehouse," I said, while again peeking into Mexico to see the giant white industrial building with a turquoise stripe across the top, "the bathroom floor just goes down and you get into the tunnel?" "Yeah," confirmed Lenoir, wearing tan fatigues and a hat with a black American flag on the side of it, a uniform different from the green of most Border Patrol agents. I had been to Otay Mesa before, in 2016, when Agent Wendy Lee told me the Border Patrol can manage with what we have and didn't need candidate Trump's border wall. My return trip was the first day of a planned month of shooting for the Dateline documentary hour I had been asked to front the month before. The project would be led by Dateline producer Izar Harpaz. The Israeli-American Harpaz, eccentric and quirky and insanely organized, would be supported by Simon Doolittle, a Dateline field producer out of Columbus, Ohio, and our unit. Before we went down in the tunnel, I interviewed Chief Rodney Scott, a Border Patrol agent for decades who worked his way up from patrol agent to chief of the San Diego sector, the largest in the nation. He brought us back to Arnie's Point, where we had broadcast from the previous month on the day of the State of the Union. Chief Scott knew how things used to be at this exact spot in the early 90s, when migrants literally ran into the United States daily for work, often turning around and going home the same day. "We were outnumbered back then," he told me, looking out at a valley where not a single migrant was in sight. "You got a group of a couple hundred coming at you. When I say coming at you, they're not coming at you, they're not coming at the whole shift. They're just coming at you and your partner in that canyon. I remember in 1994 when management came out and they said they have to figure out how to restore law and order, and they came up with a deterrent strategy," Chief Scott said, using a word I would hear time and again along the border. "Humanitarian groups believe the Clinton-era policy of prevention through deterrence, while leading to a drop in border crossings, also made those crossings purposefully more dangerous and deadly. It's an uncomfortable conversation for some in the resistance to have. In nearly three decades of deterrence-based bipartisan immigration policy, starting with Clinton, the United States border with Mexico has become increasingly militarized. Consequentially, fewer migrants have attempted to cross the southern border, but the most desperate among them haven't stopped trying. Moreover, the number of people who die trying to cross in more dangerous and deadly areas has remained constant. Clinton built the first modern wave of infrastructure, the euphemism for fences, levees, and walls, to keep people out. Under George W. Bush, in post-9/11 America, border and immigration enforcement became a part of the Department of Homeland Security. The size of the departments exploded as additional border fencing and interior enforcement went up. Under Barack Obama, more people were deported than under any other administration, earning him the nickname Deporter-in-Chief. Prison-like facilities, including some with cages, were built to process an influx of unaccompanied Central American minors seeking asylum in 2014, during Obama's second term. Once it started, deterrence, as a government policy, never stopped. The idea is that scaring people would stop them from coming to the United States. Instead, migrants just kept going to different parts of the border to avoid the deterrence put into place. Whatever you think of the policy, I pointed out to Scott, the numbers were nearly as low as they've ever been. You're welcome, he deadpanned. The Galvez smuggling tunnel between Tijuana and Otay Mesa was a byproduct of deterrence. I now stood at its mouth with Agent Lance Lenoir. Sometimes we'll see 12 in one year, sometimes we'll see 4 or 5, Lenoir told me of his confined spaces entry team. They call themselves the Tunnel Rats. He and his colleagues in this elite Border Patrol unit threw a ruby-red harness over my street clothes, tossed me a helmet and work gloves, and attached a safety cable with a carabiner to my harness. Here we go, I said, stepping into the void. It was a 70-foot descent by ladder. The tunnel was so deep, the ladder had several spots along the way to get off and rest before continuing down to the muddy floor below. Watch your head and button hook to the left, shouted an agent once I got to the bottom. I had never seen anything like it. Oh, wow, I said. Is this a pretty standard tunnel? No, this is definitely not standard. This is like the Cadillac of tunnels. The Cadillac of tunnels, I marveled. Who built this thing? Mostly low-level guys told to dig in a straight line. Told by who? Cartels? That's a safe assumption, Lenoir said. Soil and water sloshed under our feet. Cars and trucks hummed overhead, speeding into the Otay Mesa port of entry. At one point, I started to get dizzy, keeping that detail to myself as I leaned back against the wall and the crew watched Lenoir and I talk. He was unfazed, not even buckling the chin strap on his helmet when I had tightened mine within millimeters of suffocating myself, somehow thinking that would save my life if the roof collapsed in on us in an earthquake. Once you're deep enough, I asked Lenoir, you can go as far as you want? Mm-hmm. You can get under just about anything? Lenoir nodded and allowed himself a single-word response. Right. Including a border fencing or a border wall? Yes. As long as they can get from point A to point B in secret, they're gonna do it. You anticipate finding more of these? Oh, yeah. Stick around. There'll be something, Lenoir said with certainty. We all climbed back out of the tunnel. The fresh air and sun and dust kicking up from the all-weather road in the shadow of the flimsy border fencing never felt so good. Our first Dateline shoot day in the books, we packed up and headed towards San Diego before making our way to the Arizona border. As we did, something about that tunnel nagged at me. I had already learned that most hard narcotics are coming through legal ports of entry, and that marijuana smuggling, the type of bulky load that tunnels were perfect for, was declining because of the same pot legalization in California I had been reporting on. Apprehensions of migrants looking to sneak across were near all-time lows, too. Further, after forcing a brief government shutdown following a State of the Union, Trump balked,
signing a budget that did not fund his border wall, nor fix the problem he created for DACA recipients. So what was the point of that tunnel tour? Part of me felt a little hoodwinked, like what we just saw was a cheesy public relations stunt, how a Hollywood producer would draw up a border scene if it was on the back lot at Universal by my office. I wasn't even the first reporter at my own organization to tour it. The Border Patrol had taken Steve Patterson, fellow NBC News correspondent, down for a look in 2016. The truth was the San Diego border was, by all accounts, relatively quiet. If Otay Mesa, where the tunnel was dug years earlier, was of any great import to the plan President Trump had announced at the State of the Union to deter migration, it was the ICE detention center here, not the tunnel. Indeed, locked up there was the Congolese asylum seeker, who for the last 4 months had been separated from her daughter, now in an ORR shelter in Chicago. For all the border reporting I had done since I was here last, nothing about her crossed my radar. But others were on the case. February 26, 2018. As the ACLU's lead attorney fighting the Trump administration's Muslim ban, Lee Gelernt knew well how the White House was attempting to use policy to stop migrants from entering the United States. For the first year of the Trump presidency, he battled multiple versions of the ban in court. By December 2017, the administration had narrowed the policy to pass muster at the Supreme Court, allowing the United States to block residents from mostly Muslim-majority countries and nominally making waivers available for residents of those nations. "It discriminates on the basis of religion," Gelernt told NPR when the ACLU first challenged the executive order in 2017. Gelernt has the air of an avuncular college professor. He's always slightly disheveled, his thick plastic frame black glasses often perched where his hairline met his scalp. On TV, he sometimes looked exhausted, and rightly so. Gelernt, as the deputy director and chief litigator for the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, had been chasing his second massive case of the Trump era. After Lomi Creel's article in the Houston Chronicle revealed the Border Patrol had been separating hundreds of children in the El Paso area, two national outlets followed her. Both the New York Times and Washington Post on the same December day confirmed the Trump administration was again considering a national family separation policy, the same story my colleague Julia Ainsley broke back in March 2017. The Times cited evidence from a consortium of groups, including KIND, the Women's Refugee Commission, and other organizations, many of which had submitted questions to ORR the previous month at their stakeholder meeting. Those organizations and others, including the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project in Arizona, were signatories to a letter in December sent to the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and the DHS Acting Inspector General. The two institutional checks on abuses of power or violation of policy within the department. The letter documented 155 cases of family separation, including 90 in the last quarter of the year. The separated migrants had come from Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico, and Guatemala. "Our organizations have for years and in great detail documented the immense trauma created by the separation of family members and the impact of separation on their ability to pursue legal immigration relief," they wrote. "The separation of parents from their children at the U.S.-Mexico border and within the United States, absent justifiable child protection grounds, is so fundamentally unconscionable, it defies countless international and domestic laws on child welfare, human rights, and refugees." Gelernt was keeping tabs on all of it, clueless of how many children in total were being taken away from their parents, but certain of one thing. The administration wasn't considering the separation of children from their parents. It was already doing it, he later wrote. He was convinced he needed to file a class action lawsuit as soon as he could to stop family separations. Gelernt viewed the policy as a clear violation of the due process rights of families, but he didn't have a separated parent to represent. That changed when Gelernt received a tip that led him to Otay Mesa and the Congolese woman whose 6-year-old daughter had been sent to Chicago.
Gallant flew out to San Diego from New York as quickly as he could, along with an asylum lawyer and a Lingala translator. The mother appeared, quote, distraught, when the team met her. Dressed in a detention jumpsuit and gaunt from not eating or sleeping, she was wary at first, though she smiled when I attempted to say hello in Lingala, Gallant recalled in an essay he penned for the New York Review of Books. Through a translator, she explained to the asylum lawyer and me that she feared for her and her daughter's lives, and that the Catholic Church helped them flee. They traveled through 10 countries over 4 months and requested asylum when they legally presented themselves at the San Ysidro Port of Entry. When she was handcuffed and her daughter was taken from her, she heard the child scream, "Don't take me away from my mommy." Gallant explained that was the last time they would see each other for months, even though she had passed her asylum screening interview. Neither Gallant nor the ACLU had enough evidence to file a class action lawsuit, but he felt the situation was so dire and urgent that he needed to sue immediately to help. They did, and the Congolese woman and her 6-year-old daughter became Miss L and SS. The defendants were a who's who of Trump administration officials and agencies, as underscored in the first paperwork associated with the case. Miss L, petitioner plaintiff, versus U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, Thomas Homan, Acting Director of ICE, Greg Archambault, San Diego Field Office Director, ICE, Joseph Green, San Diego Assistant Field Office Director, ICE, Otay Detention Facility, Kirsten Nielsen, Secretary of DHS, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, Attorney General of the United States, Kevin K. McAleenan, Acting Commissioner of CBP, L. Francis Cisna, Director of USCIS, Pete Flores, San Diego Field Director, CBP, Fred Figueroa, Warden, Otay Mesa Detention Center, Alex Azar, Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Scott Lloyd, Director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Respondents, defendants. This is an immigration case involving the United States government's forcible separation of plaintiff from her 7-year-old daughter, SS, the lawsuit began. The message from the ACLU to the Trump administration about family separations was clear. We'll see you in court. While Gallant and his colleagues were, for the time being, only representing one mother and daughter, they would soon have the evidence they needed to raise the stakes significantly. The same day Miss L's suit was filed in federal court, the Dateline crew and I made our way to Mission, Texas. There, Border Patrol agent Robert Rodriguez took us beneath the Anzaldúas Bridge to show us where most migrants entering the Rio Grande Valley sector of the border turn themselves in after illegally swimming or rafting across the river. An increasing number of them were using this tactic in order to seek asylum when legal ports of entry, like the one Miss L and her daughter used to enter in San Diego, were effectively closed by a process known as metering, or limiting the number of people who would be let in on any given day. After we had left the tunnels of Otay Mesa 6 days earlier, we crossed the border into Tijuana, Mexico, the nation's most violent city. At the time, the city was experiencing 6 murders a day. We literally held our noses to go into the morgue where dozens of bodies were kept in refrigerators, most of them homicide victims. And we had met the leader of a human smuggling ring who crossed migrants into the United States for a living and who said nothing, including Trump's wall, would stop people from paying him to get into the United States. But the situation on the ground in Tijuana and the way people crossed there was nothing like the crossing under the Anzaldúas. The bridge itself is the longest international bridge between the United States and Mexico. And once a migrant makes it across the Rio Grande, there's still thousands of steps to go before they'll find a Border Patrol agent, usually on the levee that we were standing on, that will take them into custody. The Trump administration claimed migrants were entering the country in this way in order to exploit American laws, bringing their children because they had a better chance of gaining protections and avoiding deportation. The families told a different story. It was there I met Edwin and Edwin Jr., who arrived from Honduras with only the clothes on their backs. The father in a leather jacket and light blue polo shirt, his hair recently trimmed. His son, a full head and shoulders shorter than him, was wearing a gray hoodie under a puffy vest, hands tucked into his pockets while he tried to push his face down into it as well. "Why'd you come to the United States?" I asked him. "Because we have a lot of problems in our country," he said in Spanish, which I could make out. Agent Rodriguez translated the rest. "He has his business, but he can no longer work safely," is what he's saying. "Were you scared to come to the United States?" I asked Edwin Jr. "Sí," the little boy, maybe 6 years old, replied. "Por qué?" I asked back. He shot his eyes over to Agent Rodriguez, then back to me. "Por qué gente mala, muchas?" I heard as he tucked his face back into his clothes. "A lot of bad people, a lot of bad guys," I said back to him. They intended to seek asylum, and Edwin Sr. brought with him a driver's license and birth certificate to give over to American authorities. I thanked them for talking, and they were loaded into the back of a white van operated by a contractor to be taken for processing, likely at a facility I was unaware existed but would, in a matter of months, see for myself. Agent Rodriguez said nothing about separations, and I didn't know to ask. The next day, we flew from South Texas to Arizona, where we would again meet with the Border Patrol. While we were in the air across the Southwest, a calendar invite was sent to ORR for a call the following day. Forward. Separated Family Discussion, ICE and CBP, the subject read. The call would take place on the Erold Conference Line, the Enforcement and Removal Operations Law Division inside Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of General Counsel and the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor at ICE, of which Erold was a part, had organized the meeting. It would be another major opportunity for those looking to expose family separations to hear what was being planned. If anybody knew what was going on with family separations, it would be ICE. Separations would be carried out on the front line by the Border Patrol. But in order to get separated parents and children to adult detention and ORR shelters, respectively, ICE would have to transport them. Claire Trickler McNulty came to government service from the nonprofit sector, hoping to help change ICE from the inside. After leaving an organization providing care for migrant adults, she worked her way up through the ranks at ICE, ultimately rising to become the Deputy Assistant Director of the Office of Detention Policy and Planning, in charge of custody policy reform and managing ICE's detention networks. "I focused my whole career on adult detention," she explained to me, "and stayed to hold down what I was working on when President Trump took office." But her office, she said, was dismantled within the first weeks of the administration. Undaunted, McNulty decided to stay the course and keep her job. As the number of family separations along the border started increasing without warning, she was getting word it was presenting challenges to the agents in the field. McNulty was seeing lists of children saying they were separated, sent to ICE by ORR in an attempt to reconnect the families. "We knew we should be able to track who was who. ICE's goal was to remove both," she later told me, meaning deport parents and children together. "It's in ICE's interest to know," she said, "they were separated. But nobody could seem to easily figure out if families were, in fact, separated. That was because the IT systems used by the different component agencies that had actively been separating kids, CBP, ICE, and the Border Patrol, all used different programs to keep track of people in their custody. And those systems did not talk to each other. That made it, according to McNulty, quote, much harder, longer, and more complicated to trace back kids, and created a greater possibility for error. She wasn't alone, and colleagues of hers within ICE were actively working to fix the back-end system that was making family reunifications difficult, if not impossible, in some cases. Problem, proposal, solution is how she thought of it, and she explained as much to the lawyers at ICE who would be on the phone call the following day. If children were going to be separated, McNulty was going to make sure a solution would be worked out. We arrived in Tucson that night and drove straight to the border. It was pouring rain and pitch black when we arrived at the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, part of the Sonoran Desert in southern Arizona. The dirt road we are driving on is rapidly filling with water. My head is pounding. An intermittent flash of bright blue light disrupts the void outside. It's a rescue beacon, affixed atop a tower, meant to signal safety for anyone out here in distress. We pulled up to it and got out. The United States-Mexico border is off in the distance, maybe over that mountain, or the other one, or along a horizon I can't even see because my eyes are filled with water. In that moment, it's not hard to understand why this has been the most deadly place for migrants to attempt to cross illegally into the United States. Crippled by a migraine, I try puking. The only thing rising from my throat is a nasty, painful bunch of air as the muscles contract. Every attempt is making it worse, even though for the last hour I've been nursing a Gatorade I bought for the journey out here. Every drop of rainwater on my head feels like a sledgehammer. And anything and everything else going on around is amplifying my symptoms, including my anxiety. This, quote, hostile terrain is exactly where the Clinton administration predicted in a government document they would, quote, force migrants to cross when they enacted their, quote, prevention through deterrence border enforcement strategy. They were right. Here alone, in the Border Patrol's Tucson sector, nearly 3,000 have died since then. The local medical examiner's office in Pima County has more than 900 unidentified remains believed to be migrants. They find them in and around places just like where I am right now, and have since the first wave of fencing was put up here along the border with Sonora, Mexico. Of those who die, some starve, many die of heat exhaustion, while others are killed by animals whose venom is too potent to overcome without medical attention. I came here, fortunately, before reading Luis Alberto Urrea's book, The Devil's Highway, the true story of 26 Mexican men who attempted to traverse this isolated and dangerous part of the border in 2001. Only 12 of them survived. Those who brutally perished in 115-degree heat are known as the Yuma 14. Of one of the men's final moments, Urrea wrote, he, quote, felt death catching up to him. It was a force that came from outside him. He tried to outwalk it, but it was faster, stronger than he. He stumbled. He thought it was no use to fight any longer. The battle was finished. Death caught his clothing, and he started to fall asleep as he walked, knowing he would fall and never awaken. Now directly above me, that blue light keeps flashing. It's supposedly visible for miles in all directions, but the Yuma 14 never saw it, or any of the dozens operated by the Border Patrol. The beacons didn't exist when they died, but amid intense public scrutiny of the deterrence strategy and the rising death toll, the government set them up. The first thing you notice when you look closely at the base of one, if you're not delusional from dehydration or starvation, or suffering from severe bodily injury, are panels that show in English, Spanish, and pictographs what to do if you need help. I'm standing with the people who would rescue you if you push the button. Two Border Patrol agents, Chris and Dan, brought our crew out here to experience what crossing the Sonoran Desert in the dead of night is really like. The ordeal did me in. I couldn't move from the front seat of a white and green Border Patrol Suburban. Chris tells me he's provided intravenous fluids for migrants found out here countless times. But he's not offering me an IV, just an offer to turn around and head back to the Border Patrol station we set off from hours earlier. I take him up on it. I feel like a chicken shit. I bet the agents are of the same opinion. Tens of thousands of migrants have traversed this desert before me, and I can't handle being bucked out here in a Border Patrol four-wheel drive SUV to learn how it really is. As we head back toward the Border Patrol station where we set out from, there's no way to avoid thinking about the thousands of lives lost and the desert crossers who made it, all far stronger than my weak constitution. Chances are, one of them is living or working near, with, or for you. Who would ever choose to take this journey, or a risk like it? People like Juan, who, to provide for his family, had crossed into Arizona twice after the deaths of the Yuma 14. Some of the most desperate people on Earth. Such people were the subject of the call on ICE's Herald conference line the following day. A technical issue preventing the sharing of information between agencies was complicating reunifications of separated parents. ICE and ORR couldn't easily tell if the Border Patrol had separated a child. Everyone knew what they were seeing on the ground. ICE, ORR, and of course the Border Patrol, whose agents were doing the separation. But reunifications were not happening expeditiously or easily. The solution was an IT change. A simple box Border Patrol agents would check as they processed migrants, like the one Jennifer Podkol had suggested to ORR in January, to indicate if a parent and child were separated. In the meantime, they would use a workaround by looking at background data manually in each of the systems. While ORR continued to find out more about the challenges ICE was facing, McNulty, who was not on the line, was feeling mounting pressure. She and others scrambled to find a solution, if not to stop separations, to at least make sure families could be put back together as quickly as possible. "It was very stressful," she said. "This was awful, and I felt like kids were being traumatized and abused." 4 days later, on Saturday, March 3rd, Tyler Holton, the press secretary for the Department of Homeland Security, forwarded a request for information about Miss L., the separated Congolese asylum seeker, from the Washington Post editorial board to top DHS staff. Here is the latest inquiry from WaPo. Every major outlet asked about specifics on Wednesday. Any updated language/guidance would be very helpful. I don't imagine this is going away anytime soon. Thanks. Chad Wolf, Secretary Nielsen's chief of staff, who in December 2017 shared a draft of the family separation policy with Gene Hamilton, the aide to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, sent it along to Nielsen. "Ma'am, for your situational awareness, we're receiving a number of press inquiries regarding an asylum-seeking Congolese woman and her child who have been separated and are currently in detention facilities." Wolf pasted a statement that was currently being distributed to the press. It began, quote, "DHS does not currently have a policy of separating women and children." Nielsen wrote back, making sure that Wolf knew that news about Miss L was, quote, "also one of the stories I asked about last week." 2 days later, Miss L was abruptly released. The statement Wolf sent to Nielsen directly contradicted what the ACLU, Miss L's lawyer, was seeing on the ground. While the ACLU was able to win her release from detention in San Diego with the help of a DNA test, separations were continuing. Lee Gallant returned to federal court, this time to expand Miss L's case into a class action suit against the federal government. Whether or not the Trump administration wants to call this a policy, it certainly is engaged in a widespread practice of tearing children away from their parents, he said in a statement on March 9th. A national class action lawsuit is appropriate because this is a national practice. I am a citizen of Guatemala and am seeking asylum in the United States. When I came to the United States, I presented myself at the border at San Ysidro, California, asking for asylum. I came to the United States on or around April 20th, 2018, with my biological son, EZGA. My child is from Guatemala and seeking asylum. When we came to the United States, we reported at San Ysidro, California, and said that I wanted to seek asylum. Shortly after arriving, I was told that I was going to be separated from my son. There were no doubts expressed that I was my son's biological mother, and I have a birth certificate to show our relationship. They did not say that I was a danger to my son or was abusive. I was sent to the Eloy Detention Center in April 2018. My children were sent to an ORR facility in Phoenix, Arizona. I have not seen my children for 1 month. I worry about EZGA constantly, and I don't know when I will see them. We have talked on the phone only once. I was given a number to call, but no one answers the phone. I hope I can be with my child very soon. I miss him, and I am scared for him. I declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct, based on my personal knowledge. Executed in April 24th, 2018. Declaration of Miss MMAL, Miss L versus ICE.